3:04 on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you. We're talking Chicago, Chicago history, and tours, and all sorts of stuff like that. Michael Corcoran has just walked in the studios. Thank you very much for coming back. I know you're just on with Bill Mahler not that long ago, because you were here then to talk about, what's it called, Hollywood on Lake Michigan?
Hollywood on Lake Michigan, second edition, yes, sir.
Second edition. And let me get this straight. There was a first edition you weren't involved in.
No, Arnie Bernstein wrote that.
And so then you came to Arnie and said, you know what, Arnie, I think I could do this better. Let me just rework your book. Is that what you did?
It was kind of, I spent years bugging. I had a whole tour basically cribbed off of Arnie's book, my cinematic Chicago tour. And I met the publisher, the original publisher, Sharon Woodhouse at Lake Claremont. And I spent years bothering her, you know, make Arnie do an update. And then I met Arnie at a Lake Claremont event. And I said, you know, do an update. So I just sort of kept bugging him. And then about 5 years ago, Sharon came to me and said, well, we want to do an update, but Arnie's too busy with other stuff. Would you do it? And so I said, yeah, sure. So,
oh, very cool. Very cool. Okay, so we're going to talk about that in a little while. But what I really brought you in here for was because I saw stuff about that. But then I saw on your LinkedIn profile what you wrote about the tours that you do of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I thought it sounded really cool. So brainsnack.net is your website. Brainsnack Tours is the company, mm-hmm. right?
Brainsnack Tours, brainsnack.net.
And so this isn't a double-decker bus that tells you here's the Willis, here's the Hancock, here's the Navy Pier. You're taking people and showing them things that they wouldn't normally get about Chicago, and things I'm guessing a lot of us that have lived here our whole lives maybe wouldn't even know about Chicago.
That's one of my points of pride, is I love it when somebody comes up to me after a tour and says, you know, I've lived in Chicago my whole life, and you told me, you know, at least three or four things I had never had any idea about. That really makes me happy.
Well, what got you started in doing that? Why did you start doing tours, and why did you decide, you know what, I'm not just doing the same old boring tour, we're going to do something a little more interesting here?
Well, I originally moved to Chicago in 1987, and I was a stand-up comic. And so I was a professional stand-up for about 8 years here until about 1994. Then I kind of, you know, the comedy boom was starting to fade, and I was kind of burning out on comedy.
Nobody had handed you a sitcom yet, so.
No. Well, it got to the point where I realized that if I wanted to continue doing comedy for a living, I was going to have to move to New York or L.A. And at that point, I realized that I loved living in Chicago more than I liked doing stand-up comedy full-time. I'd really fallen in love with the city. So I went and ended up going back to school, going to DePaul School for New Learning, their adult degree program. Mm-hmm. And in the course of doing that degree, I took a course on Chicago history and a course on Chicago authors in the same quarter. So it was like this real immersion into Chicago history and Chicago culture. And that just really, really got me. And so when I graduated, the thing about this degree program is they make you design it yourself. So you have to come up with your own name. So I had this degree program called Creative Person that would allow me to develop a battery of creative skills that would allow me to become a freelance creative person. So I had this thing where I was, you know, just wanted to get a bunch of different stuff up and running. And I had this idea in my head. I was like, you know, there's some job that I can get that you can only find in Chicago that I'm uniquely qualified for my weird background. And so one summer I was just looking for a job for that summer, and I signed on with Gray Line Trolleys. And halfway through my training day, I was like, ah, this is it. So I did a summer with them, and that was kind of wacky. They're like the DC cab of the tour industry. But after that summer, I said, you know, I want to be a freelance, and I want to take, you know, I really want to do something different and make it more like a, you know, a nonfiction performance piece that just sort of happens to involve a bus and the city, or just walking around the city. So that's kind of my niche. I'm a personalized tour. You tell me where you want it to start, where you want it to end, what you want to see, or if you want to take a specialty tour. I have a bunch of specialty tours. You can mix and match. That's my thing, is that I'll just do whatever you want and give you your own personalized tour.
Well, now that I know there might be a DC cab reference in it, now I'm sold. I mean, I didn't expect to get a DC cab reference. You don't hear that very often.
Oh, I'm nothing if not a fan.
I've got a friend who loves to say, I don't work on the King's birthday, and, you know, that's straight out of DC cab. tell me So if I do call, you said you know, I could tell you I want to start here, I want to end there, and you'll put together a tour. In general, the ones that you kind of have already, what would those be? If I said, well, give me four options on a tour, what would you suggest?
Well, a lot of people, they like my Cinematic Chicago tour, or they just, a lot of time when people come in, they want the highlights. So I give them the general highlights with a twist.
Well, we don't want the highlights. That's the general stuff you're going to get everywhere.
I have my deluxe ethnic Chicago tour. That's a four-hour tour. Basically, I go through, you know, most of Chicago, talk about all the different ethnic groups, when they came, what mm-hmm. they did, and you know, stuff like that. That's kind of popular. I have one about tragic Chicago. I mean, go by places where horrible, tragic things happen, like the Eastland disaster a little ways up the river.
The Eastland disaster, I had never known about, or I don't know how I heard about it here at the Tribune somehow, but there's a building right down there that if you go inside the lobby, they've got some great artifacts. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know there's a big plaque to the Eastland victims in City Hall.
There's a plaque right there on the River Walk. Mm-hmm. But also one of the buildings here on the north side of the river, one of the red buildings that faces there, I think the one with the clock on the top that see in the pictures from the Eastland disaster, I think that's the one. If you go in the lobby or one of the buildings right there, there's a lobby that has some big pictures and the whole story of the day. It's pretty cool. So if you're taking people, find that lobby because you can bring them right in there, see the pictures and the stories, and it's pretty amazing. And somebody, who was it that was, you know what I just read this year, I believe, George Halas
was supposed to be on it. And he overslept.
He was late.
He overslept and got there just as the boat was pulling out and flipping over, basically.
And that's an amazing story. If people don't know, it's still one of the greatest maritime disasters in our nation, right?
Yeah.
And it's just people. Was it Westinghouse Electric?
Yeah.
It was a company picnic type thing. We're going to go out on a boat on the river, and the way they loaded
the
boat.
Michigan City.
Okay.
And
to the lighthouse, were they going to do some outlet shopping?
they were going to hit the Nike store. They were going to go to Michigan City. There was going to be a parade for them and a huge picnic and stuff. And the boat flipped over.
Because they just loaded it wrong, right? It was just too much weight on one side. And it just turned.
It was a perfect storm of things. A lot of it was because of the Titanic. The Titanic had sunk, you know, several years before.
Okay.
And when everybody found out about how there weren't enough boats for everybody, they sort of shoved through this real, you know, sort of shoddy law, just a quickly made law about boats for everyone. This law that they had to have enough boats for everybody who would possibly be on there. So they had to put all these extra boats. They put them above the deck. They'd also just put a new concrete deck on top, you know.
A concrete deck?
Yeah, like an inch thick concrete deck.
Okay.
So it was top heavy because of all those things. They say it's because a lot of the people ran to one side, but that's probably not actually what happened. There was a bunch of other things that there's a whole book about just basically all the things that had to happen for this to happen.
And basically what happened was it's not like it went out into the lake and then something happened and it sunk. Just as people got on, it turned over on its side.
Yeah, it was just about to go.
The boat wasn't completely underwater. Some of it was still above water, right? It just turned sideways, and enough people were stuck and just couldn't get out, right?
It completely flipped over. A lot of people were trapped underneath the decks. Mm-hmm. A lot of people went into the river. The river at that time especially was not somewhere you'd want to be thrown into. I mean, it was really polluted and stuff. And, yeah, it was just a froth of people crying and screaming for help. There was apparently a man on the Clark Street Bridge who was contemplating suicide. He'd been standing on the bridge contemplating suicide for like about a half an hour. And then when he saw the disaster, he jumped in and started saving people, ended up saving several people.
Wow.
It was just, it was over 800 people died, entire buildings in Cicero where people, you know, because it was the Czech Bohemian community of Cicero mostly, like entire buildings were depopulated. It was really a truly horrible thing.
We're speaking with Michael Corcoran. The website for the tour is brainsnack.net. More talk about Chicago history when we come back. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. We're talking with Michael Corcoran about Chicago history, Chicago tours. Of course, that's the Blues Brothers singing Sweet Home Chicago, the longtime theme song for Cap every night when he starts Sports Central or the David Kaplan Show. I imagine he still uses it quite a bit. Michael, to me, the Blues Brothers is probably the quintessential Chicago movie. I have a 12-year-old son, and I just showed him the Blues Brothers for the first time last week. And I hadn't watched it in at least 10 or 15 years. You know, I'll catch a bit of it here and there on cable, but we actually bought it on video on demand and watched it with my son. And he was like, I don't know, is this a musical? What is it? Da, da, da. And he ended up loving it. And afterwards, and I hadn't seen it in a long time, but he loves architecture, and he loved, so I was very excited for him to get to see Chicago in the early 80s, late 70s. But also I thought, boy, look at the musical taste that kids are introduced to, or anybody's introduced to, who might not love the blues or know it. You got Aretha Franklin performing in it. You have John Lee Hooker performing in it.
Ray Charles.
And then the Blues Brother, and who's the gentleman who sings Minnie the Moocher? Cab Calloway. I mean, you have some real legends in this popular film marketed at a bunch of white kids. Mm-hmm. I think it was a pretty neat thing.
Yeah, the studio didn't know what to do with it while they were making it, because they didn't know. Is it a musical? Is it a comedy?
Right.
What's going on? You know, it was quite a conundrum. But, you know, when it came out, you know, everybody loved it.
There was a great article, I'm guessing it was in the Tribune a year or two ago, about the Blues Brothers and the making of it. And I imagine that Dan Aykroyd was reflecting on it and how they went in to see Jane Byrne and had to pitch her on what they wanted to do to Daily Plaza. And it was a big, like well, we got to, you know, here's the thing. We'll fix all this. We promise, da, da, da. And he said they realized afterwards, as soon as they said, we're going to smash up Daily Plaza, she's like, go for it. She loved the idea. They thought that, what the hell, go ahead, destroy Daily Plaza. That's hilarious to me. And gave him the go ahead. Which, it's funny to me that those two went in and met with her, that it wasn't just a production crew and things like that. I guess Chicago didn't really have the film office, the mechanisms they probably have now, quite as thick as
there,
things are
there
now.
There was a film office at the time, but it was just basically the Blues Brothers was the first one that really blew the top off, you know, started off what I call the contemporary era of Chicago film.
Interesting. All right, we're going to get back to more film later on, because I want to ask Michael what he thinks are, you know, because to me it's the Blues Brothers, it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I'm sure there's a lot of films that I don't think of that have Chicago as a theme, or based in Chicago, or maybe aren't based in Chicago at all, but were filmed in Chicago. So we'll talk a little bit about that more later on. Let's go back to Brainsnack Tours. Brainsnacktours.net is the website if you want to find out more about the tours that Michael will give and can give. But I want to ask you, so I don't want a tour about films in Chicago, and I don't want a tour about Gangland Chicago. I think that's too typical.
I don't do the gangster thing.
Good. So give me something that if I just, I want to know something about Chicago, I don't know. Where do you want to take me? What do you want to show me?
You know, that's such a hard question.
Well, what's your favorite? There's something that, maybe there's a lot of things, but what's something that you get excited every time you tell somebody about? Because, you know, their face is going to light up and go, get out! I did not know that.
The place I love to take a group, if they want to go on a sort of a side trip, it's a really obscure place, and it just underwent some rehabilitation. It's the Elks Monument at Diversey and... basically, Diversey near the lakefront. I think it's Sheridan or Lake.
Okay, I have no idea what this is. So what's the Elks Monument?
It's the Elks were they still are a fraternal organization.
Sure.
It's a monument that they built dedicated to all the Elks who died during World War I. And they built it in the early 20s, and they got a lot of money to do it, and they spared no expense, and they got some of the greatest artists in the country at the time to do statuary and stuff. It's just, it's incredible. I mean, to say it's over the top is an understatement. You have to go down a few stories to
really
hit the top. You walk in there, it's 100-foot tall rotunda. It has all these pillars made from 12 different kinds of marble.
So it's a building or it's an outdoor
monument?
It's
a building. You go inside.
Okay.
If you're ever down, if you're down by Diversey, say you're going down Diversey towards the lakefront, there's that just round building. Looks kind of a lot of people say, oh, they're afraid to go in because it looks kind of like a private place, but it's actually open to the public most every day, and they'd love it when you go in there. But it's just incredible, and it has this beautiful drawing room that's they actually used it for a scene in the movie Richie Rich that Johnny's, they ended up, but they scratched the floor really bad, so they never, now they don't let
anybody
movie,
film in that.
Yeah, anybody film in there.
Oh, ruined by Richie Rich, not one of our landmark movies in Chicagoland. Well, that sounds pretty cool. Tell me something architecturally. What do you tell people? Because architecture is such a big thing in Chicago. Besides the skyscrapers, what else do you talk about?
Well, I mean, there's the big skyscrapers, the modern skyscrapers. But I love to take people down Dearborn because that was the main business drag in the 1880s, 1890s. And there are some of the oldest skyscrapers in the world there. There's the Manhattan Building at the corner of basically Congress and Dearborn, done by William LeBaron and Jenny, the father of the modern skyscraper. Beautiful, crazy. Actually, it's a sort of a crazy building because a lot of architectural people don't like it because it uses a bunch of different styles. But my thing is, it's like a jazz player just trying to play every single possible chord change of this new song that is the skyscraper. It has these beautiful gargoyle faces. It has bay windows about the fourth floor, and then these gargoyles looking down on from the bays. It's a beautiful, beautiful building. You keep moving down, and there's the Plymouth Building. Old Colony Building has those round corner bays. Then you get into the next block, and there's the Fisher Building, which is beautiful, sort of a burnt umber terracotta with all these. The architect, Charles Atwood, did a lot of visual puns, because Lucius Fisher was the name of the person who commissioned the building was named after. So he put like salamanders and little fish and ospreys on the side of it. Into the terracotta. It's a lot of fun. Then you go down, and across the street is the Monadnock Building, kind of like the first. Well, basically, there's two parts of it. The northern half of it is the last masonry building, basically, that was ever built before the advent of the modern skyscraper. It's 16 stories tall, and the thing about masonry buildings is the first floor has to bear the weight. So the first floor of the Monadnock, that part of the Monadnock building, is really thick. It's that one you see across from the Federal Plaza. It sort of looks like an Egyptian pylon. It's just very sleek, and it goes up. But the southern half was built a couple of years later after the John Root had died. Mm-hmm. And it was built by another firm, and that's in the steel frame. It's actually a steel frame skyscraper. So like the boundary between the two halves of the building is kind of like the sacred ground to modernist architecture fans.
And all these skyscrapers kind of came to being because of the Chicago Fire and because Chicago started rebuilding. I'm guessing there's not a lot you can really do on the Chicago Fire because basically it destroyed most everything. Do you do much on the Chicago Fire in the tours?
Well, what I do is I'll take people to where the fire started, out at the West Side.
Which is where the Fire Academy is now, right?
Yeah, where that basically that tongue of flame statue is where Mrs. O'Leary's barn stood. And I'll sort of wax rhapsodic about that day and, you know, how everything was made of wood and, you know, and,
right.
And just the, you know, all that.
My son, who's in seventh grade this year, last year in sixth grade, did his history project on the Chicago Fire. So I get to learn a lot of cool things about it and, you know, different theories and stuff like that. And where do we stand with Mrs. O'Leary? Because basically it's they can't prove it. They don't think that really was.
There's a gentleman he's a title lawyer and an amateur historian, and he made it his life's work to sort of vindicate the cow. And a lot of this happened in the 90s, and he studied the testimony from the fire commission and stuff, and looked at old maps. And basically the theory is that there was a man in the neighborhood named Daniel Pegleg Sullivan, mm-hmm. sort of a neighborhood ne'er-do-well kind of guy. And he said that he was standing on a certain part in a certain area, and he could see the O'Leary barn on fire. And this guy looked at these maps, realized that there was a 5-story building standing between where Pegleg said he was and where the, you know, between him and the barn. So he started looking into it. And the theory now is kind of that Pegleg, there was a raging bash going on down the street, and they were drinking a popular drink at the time, which was sort of whiskey and fresh cow's milk, sort of a primitive Irish cream. Yeah. And so the theory is that Pegleg was in there. Pegleg's mom had a cow in Mrs. O'Leary's barn. She rented out, you know, space to other people's cows. And they think he was stealing some milk from his mom's cow and either knocked over the lamp or, you know, skittified the cow. That's the money.
Sure, sure. Got the cow scared and then something got kicked over, and that's how it started.
Yeah.
But they do know for sure that it was in the barn.
Yeah, it had definitely happened. It started up in the barn, and so something went, you know. But they ended up in the 90s, at a certain point, they had a mock trial. And,
right.
And the cow was acquitted, and they had the city council resolution, you know, sort of absolving Mrs. O'Leary and then the cow.
Which is like the same thing as when the goat gets absolved from Wrigley every 5 years. I mean, there's no real weight in that, right? Was it more for show, or do you really think it definitely wasn't the cow, but somehow the fire started in this barn?
Most historians are pretty, they think it started in the barn, but Mrs. O'Leary had nothing to do with it and the cow. It was sort of a story that was used as a cudgel to sort of beat down the Irish community.
We're speaking with Michael Corcoran of Brain Snack Tours, brainsnacktours.net. Lots more Chicago coming up here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you, 720 WGN. We're speaking with Michael Corcoran, who does Brain Snack Tours. He's got the second edition of Hollywood on Lake Michigan out now in book form. You can buy that online anywhere, Michael, I imagine. Is it also in local bookstores, I hope?
Absolutely.
If you can find a local bookstore.
Absolutely. Any bricks and mortar bookstore or online, all over the world it's available.
Just off the air just now, you were telling me an interesting story about what building were we just talking about?
It's called the Reliance Building.
Okay.
Originally. It's now the Burnham Hotel. It was built by Daniel Burnham's firm. And the story is that a man bought the lot.
Okay.
And there was a 4-story masonry building there. And he really wanted his friend Daniel Burnham to build a skyscraper, one of these new skyscrapers.
Okay.
But the problem was there were the businesses on the top 2 floors of the 4-story building had leases that weren't up for 4 years. But this guy was in a hurry. So what they ended up doing was they jacked up the top 2 floors of the building and then demolished the bottom 2 floors in the basement. And they dug it out and they built the first 2 floors of what became the Reliance Building. And then after 4 years, they kicked the people on the top 2 floors out. They demolished the rest of it. But in the intervening time, John Root, the original architect, had died, and they lost his plans for that original tower were lost. So the next architect that Burnham had, his next chief architect, Charles Atwood, ended up designing a whole new tower. And that's the Reliance Building. And it's one of the classic Chicago school buildings. Beautiful light terracotta with huge windows.
And he built it on top of those first 2 floors? I mean, tearing apart a building like that, jacking up 2 floors so you can tear apart the bottom in 1890, I must have been an insane expense.
Well, it's actually, I think part of the reason was the guy who owned the building, William Hale, he owned a hydraulics company.
Oh.
But the thing is they jacked up the entire city about 20 years before. Basically, Chicago was
talking about
swamp.
Upper Lower Michigan and stuff
everything, the entire city. Because the streets were at grade level and they were quagmires during the wet times and dust during the dry periods. So what they ended up doing is in basically the 1850s, around the 1850s for about a decade, they ended up jacking up the whole city about between 7 and 14 feet.
Wait,
and then raised
the
sidewalk.
I don't understand. What do you mean they jacked up the whole city? How can you jack up the city?
You just raise the buildings, put in
every building in the city.
Well, walk to the river and you can look. I mean, this whole, and it's continued over the decades. And now basically the whole downtown is about, you know, 60 feet above the ground. I mean, if you go to the river, you know, walk over there, you're not at the river. You got to go down those stairs.
So basically you're saying the buildings, they lifted up the streets. So the buildings, like, you know, the Tribune Tower really starts below Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. So basically the streets started getting higher and the buildings were...
No, they jacked up the buildings. I mean, there was one building, the Tremont Hotel. They ended up raising it about 7 feet overnight.
With hydraulics underneath the building?
Basically, they had thousands of guys with cranks, and they had...
Come on.
No, seriously. They coordinated them with flags and whistles. So it was all these thousands of guys cranking these things in, and it raised it 7 feet overnight, didn't spill a glass, didn't wake a guest. The only reason the guests knew that it had happened is the next morning the stairs leading out were steeper. That's basically, and that's why when you go to old neighborhoods that were really old neighborhoods that were out of the path of the fire, like Chinatown and Bridgeport, you'll see houses that are sunken, mm-hmm. like, you know, because basically what people did is a lot of them, they jacked up the house if they could, but a lot of them just basically filled it in and then made the second floor the front house. So when you go to Pilsen, you go on these side streets, you'll see these sunken houses where the people were either couldn't afford it or were just too stubborn to do anything.
Bob is called in from Homer Glen. Bob, you're on 720 WGN. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Back in the 1800s and 1900s, Chicago was a major railroad hub in the country.
Absolutely.
Everybody traveled by train back then, and they would come into Chicago and then disperse to the rest of the country from that. When I was in high school in the 50s, my dad had the produce concession for the railroads, and his buddy had the liquor concession. His nice. Buddy would pick me up from Carmel High School and take me down to the yards where the trains would come in, and I'd jump on them with a big wire basket full of liquor and booze and put them in the dining cars. And I did all of the major railroads, the Santa Fe's, the Milwaukee Roads, Union Pacifics, and every one of them.
Wow.
And they have some very famous guests there, too. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes, we're hearing it all, Bob. Very
and
cool.
I used to get orders from the porters for famous movie stars, and Marilyn Monroe used to drink 4 bottles of Slitch on the New York Central 20th Century Limited going to New York, which is a 22-hour run. And Spencer Tracy used to drink 5 bottles of Hag and Hag, which he got 4 shots out of, each one between Chicago and New York. And I asked the guys, what does he drink on the Super Chief from L.A. to Chicago? He says, every place we stopped, he had 4 of them. That was the major way to travel back then on the train.
People had to travel, and then they always had to lay over in Chicago. That was sort of Chicago's thing.
Yeah.
There were no trains that went through Chicago, so they'd lay over. That's why the Pump Room had so many celebrities, because they would basically pick them up at the train station and just take them to the Pump Room so they could enjoy their layover.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. It's funny because now we're a layover place for airplanes. Mm-hmm. Train travel, is it still a big part of Chicago? I mean, I know Amtrak runs to L.A. and things like that, still out of Chicago. But it's there's a romanticism now about train travel. My brother-in-law took his boys on a train trip to Portland last year. And so mm-hmm. you're seeing a lot more scenic and traveling by train for those reasons. Frankly, when I've looked at it, it's not that much cheaper than flying. And it takes forever. So unless you're going to really enjoy that, it doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be that great of an option.
It's more of a, you know, just for the experience, I think. But, you know, Union Station still moves a lot of people around every day.
Mostly locally, though, right?
Mostly locally. Still a lot of stuff. I mean, I have groups that come in via the train. A lot of them, there's a company up in Minnesota I work with a lot, and they'll take the train in mm-hmm. to Chicago,
sure.
and then somebody, the bus driver drives the bus here, and then he picks them up at the train station, takes them around, and then they ride the bus back. So they get the full thing.
How interesting. Tom is in Oakland, Oak Lawn. Tom, you're on 720 WGN. How are you?
Hi, guys. I enjoy your show, Mike. Your tour sound great. I just had a question for you.
Sure.
And that would be, I wondered if you ever considered having a comedy-specific tour.
Like going to comedy sites or where the old clubs were?
Well, actually, yeah, like going, well, you could, like, to kill a bunch of birds with one stone if you went to, like, the Civic Center and City Hall area. You know, right there where they filmed a lot of the Blues Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And also going to, like, Marquette Park where they drove, you know, and jumped, had the Nazis jump in the lagoon there.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, Wrigley Field and maybe go by Second City. And then my one thing that I just wanted to say that would be my cherry in the Sunday was, and then when you took them to all these places, maybe you could make a deal with a comedy club and let the individual do 2 to 3 minutes of stand-up.
Wow, that should be a heavy price on that ticket, Tom. Are you looking for a way to get to open mic? Is that what's going on here, Tom?
Well, I mean, it would be an opportunity because they'd only be performing against with the people at the tour.
Sure.
So it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be that heavy duty.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's
just that's something I always thought of. It would be fun.
Thank you very much, Tom. That's something for you to think about.
Yeah,
for putting
I'll definitely
into
give
the,
that some thought.
Well, how, you know, I imagine a lot of the stuff he mentioned is actually covered, though, in the tour. I mean, we're talking about the places where the Blues were, the Hollywood on Lake Michigan
tour.
Yeah, the
Cinematic Chicago tour covers a lot of that stuff, yeah.
We had a caller from Highland Park. Ray was wondering if you could expand on the individual who was contemplating suicide when the Eastland disaster happened. Is there more information on him that people can find?
I just remember reading that in a book about the Eastland. That's about all they said, was that there was this gentleman who was on the bridge contemplating suicide, and then when he saw the disaster happen,
he started saving
jumped
people.
Jumped in, yeah.
All right, you and I originally started talking about the World's Columbian Exposition, the Chicago World's Fair of 1893. This was all set up, where the Museum of Science and Industry is now, was basically the north end of what was a rather large, amazing setup for a World Fair. How long was the fair? Because it wasn't just a few months or a year, right?
It went from May 1st to October 31st.
So it was all within 1893.
Mm-hmm. It was the whole summer of 1893. During that period, let's see, how many people visited? Like about 25 million people visited, including a quarter of the population of the United States.
A quarter of the population of the United States came through what is now Jackson Park in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
In a 7-month period. That's amazing.
And the amazing thing is that not a lot of people came for the first couple of months. It wasn't until the summer that they really picked up.
How many years did they spend? Because when you look at all these buildings, how many years did they spend building this or something that landed that last?
About
that
3 years, because in February 14th, 1890, Chicago won the right to host the exposition. And then they gave them an extra year because it was 1892. It was to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus landing in the New World. So they gave them an extra year and made it 1893, although there was an official dedication day on October 21st in 1892. They had a big parade. They had a huge parade, actually. Let's see, how many people had? They had a civic parade that had 75,000 participants and took 3 hours to go by, had the whole downtown. You know, around the downtown. Then the next day they had a parade that started in what we know as Grant Park today. And then, you know, several thousand troops and a military band and all these people, basically the whole entire U.S. diplomatic corps, the whole U.S. cabinet, the vice president, the House of Representatives and the Senate. They all had this huge parade that went down all the way down Michigan Avenue to Washington Park. Long parade, lined the entire way with people. And then they went to Washington Park, where there was a crowd of 100,000 people, and they had a deafening blast of artillery. And then they marched down the Midway Plaisance, which was also lined with people. And then they went into the exposition grounds, where there were another 200,000 people. And then they walked into the uncompleted Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building, where they had 100,000 people sitting in folding chairs, and they had a big dedication ceremony.
They literally, in that Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building, had 100,000 people in folding chairs?
In folding chairs. I mean, that building was so big. I mean, you could have taken the Sears Tower and pull it out of the ground and lay it on its side, and it would have fit inside the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building. It was the largest enclosed building ever built at the time.
We're speaking with Michael Corcoran. BrainSnackTours.net is where he does his tours through. You can check him out there. We're going to talk lots more about the Columbian Exposition and take your phone calls at 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on WGN Radio. Still, we got 10 more minutes with Michael Corcoran, BrainSnackTours.net. Let's get this call in real quick so we can not miss out on Tyrone calling in from Rockford. How are you, Tyrone?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question for Michael?
Yes. I want to know, what all can you tell me about Chicago's first railroad? That's one I always like to throw out.
Railroad, let's see. I think it was built by William Ogden. It wasn't very long. It was only about 20 miles out to the, I believe it went out to the one of the western suburbs.
Tyrone, I think you have the answer on this.
Yeah, I think you might know more about it than me.
Well, it was misnamed. I'd like to know if you know why that was.
You stumped me, Tyrone.
Tell us about it, Tyrone.
Well, it's kind of funny because normally you would think it would have been called the Chicago and Galena, but it was called the Galena in Chicago. And it had to do with the lead mine district in Galena, and it never made it to Galena. It only made it as far as Freeport. And I was wondering if he knew that by any chance.
No, one of my weak points is the early railroad. I know about the I&M Canal, and by the time the I&M Canal, by the time they finished it, they'd already built that first railroad. But that's.
Can I ask you when a building was erected? It's actually my favorite building in Chicago.
Test them out. What is it?
The First National Bank building. That's my favorite architecture.
You mean the A-shaped building?
The big high square one, the real high square one that kind of like gets narrow as it goes up to the top from the bottom.
I think it's...
That was built in the 70s, wasn't it? I've got a copy at home.
Actually, it was built in... says 19. I happen to have my little copy of Pocket Guide to Chicago Architecture by Judith Payne McBrien. It's a very valuable one. That was between 64 and 69 was built. It was completed in 1969.
Yeah, they always either called it the First National Bank Building or they always referred to it as First Chicago.
Well, every time a bank gobbles up another bank, it changes its name. I think now it's the Chase Tower.
Yeah, probably, but I like to keep the original names to stuff.
Oh, I
we understand,
you.
Tyrone. Thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate it. Have a great night.
Okay, you too.
Thank you. I have a copy of a Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine at home. Mm-hmm. One time back when I worked here with John Williams, we were cleaning out, I think, Roy Leonard's old stuff. I think when Roy retired,
really?
he had just, file cabinets full of stuff. And wow. I think we had his office. He'd left a bunch of stuff behind. They had all these old Chicago Tribune Sunday magazines. And so I have one that I kept that on the cover... It's the Sears Tower being built, the Hancock being built off in the distance, and I want to say this building is in there having just been completed or something like that. They were all relatively around, you said 67, I think. So then were the other two probably starting construction or near construction then?
Let's see.
Because they were like 71, 72,
yeah, the
somewhere
Sears
in there,
Tower
right?
Took a long time to finish. For many years, it was a hole in the ground, and it was sort of a city joke about they're building the world's tallest building, and it's been nothing but a hole in the ground for 2 years. Let me look that up, though. Yeah, I refuse to call in anything but the Sears Tower.
I don't use
the W word. Let's see. One second here while I try to remember how an index works.
While you're looking that up, I'm going to start talking about the Columbian Exposition again because we're about to wrap up. But, I've been talking about this off air. The footprint for the Columbian Exposition is still pretty much there. It's Jackson Park in that area. I went to Mount Carmel High School, which is kind of right across the street. And I worked at the Museum of Science and Industry. So I'm a huge fan of this whole time and that era. And I know that the area around it is all pretty much park. And there's a little bit of there. It's not
it's
like it's been rebuilt.
There. Yeah,
it's,
Jackson Park and that Jackson
are the foundations
Park golf
still there and stuff, or was everything completely torn down and hauled away? What happened?
A lot of it
everything?
Was burnt. A lot of it was burnt
on
afterwards.
Purpose.
Well, some of it was burnt on purpose. Basically, a financial panic hit America just as the exposition was beginning, and in a lot of ways, it staved, the exposition helped stave it off for the summer. But after the exposition, you know, and the fall came, a huge financial sort of, you know, depression hit America and Chicago especially. And there were a lot of homeless people living in those buildings and building fire. So a couple of them caught fire accidentally. And then there was a bitter rail strike in 1895, started in the Pullman, you know, area and spread across the country. And that's when they pretty much think angry union folks just put the torch to the whole court of honor. The whole court of honor went up in flames.
Really? Wow.
And the thing was, is there was sort of a national malaise towards the end of the summer of the exposition, because everyone knew the exposition was going to end and all these buildings were going to sort of molder. And there was actually some people that were talking about purposely putting it all to the torch so that we wouldn't have to watch it fade away.
So you'd have this memory of this glorious time and then it was gone.
Yeah, and then it would be gone.
And they built it to be temporary buildings just to get it done in time and probably to save cost as well.
Mm-hmm. And it was just such a huge undertaking. I mean, over 200 buildings, so.
And the only building left is now the Museum of Science and Industry, but it's a replica of the building. It's on the exact place and it's the exact building.
It's a permanent structure. Yeah.
But you said that it was more of a permanent building when it was built in the first place because of what it was housing for the exposition, right?
Yeah, it had some brick interior and it was fireproofed. But most of all the buildings were made of what was called staff, which was a mixture of plaster of Paris and hemp fiber, just sort of a rope thing. And what they did is they'd build sort of a shell, and then they'd just slap this stuff over it. It was sort of a stucco, a very elaborate stucco.
So if we wanted to find Oprah and Bill Gates and some other people who decided instead of saving the world, let's rebuild the world's Columbian Exposition, it could be done because the land is still available, basically.
Still there, yeah. I'd sort of have a crackpot desire to rebuild the exposition, you know.
Get the
motto
website
is,
up and let's get
finish
going.
What Julius Rosenwald started.
Well, Daniel Burnham said what?
Make no little plans.
Make no small plans. So let's make these big plans. Michael Corcoran, thank you so much for spending the hour with us. This is fascinating.
Oh,
we will
pleasure.
Do this again. Brainsnack.net, right?
Brainsnack.net, yeah.
Brainsnack.net for the tours and the second edition of Hollywood on Lake Michigan. Find out more about that at chicagocinema.net.
Yes, sir.
Two great ways to see Michael Corcoran. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.